This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
This programming is sponsored by Linscomb Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at LinscombWealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us as we talk a little politics this week. Brandon, I don't know if you know this, but the wall apparently is getting built, according to the president.
As promised, I guess.
As promised, but Mexico is still not going to pay for it.
I guess not. Now, that was something that didn't come up in conversation during the budget negotiations, right?
And who's going to pay for it, I think, is the big issue. And we'll talk about that when we spend a little time in the deep. But before we get to that, drum roll, please. We've got a few more contestants competing for the Democratic pageant known as the 2020 primary. Feel the burn, baby.
Right.
You know what?
The
youthful vigor of the Democratic primary is getting that much younger.
Wow, the average age has popped up at least, 30 more years?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe not 187, but maybe more like 127.
Gotcha. Well, here's the question. Does the Democratic Party still feel the burn, Jay, right? I mean, 2016 was a long time ago politically. You had Hillary Clinton in the race, who was viewed, I think, by a lot as the establishment figure, and Bernie was the outsider. Is that same dynamic going to hold? Does he have to recreate that? Is there, another option in the race that might just supplant his support?
Yeah. So from my perspective, I think the problem that Bernie Sanders has, and as we're talking about, Bernie Sanders has announced he is, by all accounts, the most popular politician in the United States. If you look at the polling, regardless of party preference, and he's one of the most popular Democrats running today, or at least even though he's an independent,
yeah,
aligns with the Democrats. But here's the
issue.
Quote,
Democrats, quote.
Quote, yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, I think the issue for Sanders is this. One, there are basically younger, more diverse,
yeah,
versions of Bernie Sanders running.
Yeah.
Last time he was the clear alternative choice to the establishment and sort of that 90s redux in Hillary Clinton. Now you've got essentially everyone saying the same thing.
Right.
Most of his signature issues have essentially been taken.
Yeah.
By candidates who, in many cases, are better at presenting it than even Sanders is.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how he sells. That said, the left lane of the progressive party in this country is almost completely jammed,
yeah,
up. And the center left is essentially occupied by almost no one, maybe Amy Klobuchar,
mm-hmm,
depending on your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
We still don't have Joe Biden. We still don't have Jared Brown from Ohio.
What about Beto?
And Beto. Beto's the guy. You got the lane wide open for him. Whether he gets in, we'll see.
Well, he said end of the month, so with that time clock is ticking. I think you're right. I mean, controlling for name recognition, Bernie is one of the more favored, but he's not the most favored. In fact, in this case, Harris and Warren are more favored, which means in some ways, like you say, his kind of left-leaning progressive politics have been supplanted by somebody else. But they're all leading, and that's something which I think is certainly notable. So although Bernie is not exactly, new and shiny, it is the case that that sort of politics can play. The problem for him is that he's going to have some struggle connecting to black voters, possibly women voters, right? There have been some controversies that have come out where he wasn't as diverse in his campaign staff as he could have been. He also had some problems with the harassment within the campaign that he didn't address. The Democratic Party in 16, the electorate was 58% women and 38% non-white. Bernie's going to have to connect to that group in a way that he is going to have a struggle with and the other individuals can.
I do think the advantage he has, at least with this field, is because it's so large,
yeah,
and so diverse that it splinters off so many little groups that you run into a situation where the candidate that's most liked, sort of everyone's second or third choice, has a real opportunity. And so if you're Sanders and you've got a loyal, which we know he does,
yeah,
and strong cohort of voters, you can kind of eke your way through this primary process, picking up state after state.
Yeah.
He's going to be successful in Iowa. He's a virtual home state, although he's going to be competing with Elizabeth Warren in New Hampshire. he's got he's proven that he can do well in some of these small states, and I think it's going to lead to a potential where there's a sort of the bigger the field, the better for Bernie.
I think that's right to a point. The problem then is that the Democratic Party has decided this week that they're going to cut off debate at the top 20. And we're like 10 right now, so just get
12,
ready for more.
12, I think.
Yeah, like just get ready for more, right? I think that there's an opportunity for Bernie, but there are some problems. I mean, for the Iowa caucuses, they're allowing for a non-in-person component, which could potentially bring in moderates where he would otherwise do really well, right, in an organizational structure like that. The other thing is that Trump is not going to have a primary, probably, right, hold that fire for a second, in early primaries. And so if it's the case that you've got moderates in New Hampshire able to vote, they may not choose to vote for Republicans, may choose to vote in the Democratic primary. That may actually pull some support towards a more moderate member. So it's going to be in flux of the first couple of primaries for sure. Until we get to Texas and California, we're not going to know a lot.
Well, speaking of Republicans and primary, former Massachusetts Governor William Weld is saying, guess what? He's running for president of the United States as a Republican.
Yep.
He was the VP nominee for the Libertarian ticket back in 2016. How serious should we be taking William Weld?
I don't think that serious. I mean, challengers to sitting presidents tend to be not that successful. But it does tell us a lot about where the Republican primary electorate is. I mean, if it's the case that he can go into Iowa and New Hampshire and, you know, carve off a bunch of support the way, say, that like Eugene McCarthy did against Lyndon Johnson in 1968, it may show that the party's moving in a certain direction, but I think this is going to be more about annoying Trump than it is about actually beating Trump.
Well, I mean, we know that from the data that the historical norm is really two-term presidents. And so the caveat to that is when there's an independent bid, and which we might have in Howard Schultz, and or a primary challenge. And so there you have
support's
the makeup.
Support's going to drop for the incumbent, so it could be a problem.
Yeah, you've got the makeup of a potential here, but we have a long way to go to see if Weld can do anything.
And Trump is really rescaling the operation. I mean, it was kind of amateurish in 16, but they spent a lot of money to get things organized. So it's going to be much more top-down than it was. So they'll run a better race. The politics aside, they're going to have a structurally better campaign.
Well, when you have all these Democratic candidates out there, the big question is, what will the guy that's really, really liked among Democrats do in this? And that's President Barack Obama.
Yep.
He's saying he's not gonna pick a horse this cycle.
You know, probably smart, right? Stay aside just in case, one of them implodes. But, you know, his support and even tacit support in places like South Carolina and even Texas and California is going to be a big deal. So he won't have specific support, but it could be that he and the network of Obamaites is aiding somebody in some way.
Well, you know, we're talking 2020, but 2016 is still in the news. The New Jersey Attorney General is looking at the Trump inauguration and sort of the issues surrounding it, who was giving money, who was not giving money, how it was being spent. There was a pretty prominent report that essentially they raised more and did less with that money than ever before. How serious should we be taking this?
Yeah, I mean, the concern here is in part that, you know, people who are outside the country are donating illegally to these. That is a serious problem. This is a new front, I think, in ethics questions for the Trump presidency, but one in which they may take in stride. I mean, they haven't taken any of them terribly seriously, so we'll see how that handles inside the White House. But we know the cumulative effect of these scandals has a significant erosion on legislative support, and the president is going to need to put some wins on the board in the next couple of years. I mean, the fact that the wall is still being negotiated if the emergency goes through and if it's not struck down by the courts, Congress could respond. The president needs Republicans to hold the line, and this is the kind of thing that might actually hurt him.
Well, speaking of the courts, the Supreme Court is back in queue talking about the census. So as we know that the Trump administration had put in a question asking about citizenship, and it was initially struck down at the district court level. It's now working its way through the process. The Supreme Court has taken up the case, and so they're going to make the ultimate decision. We know that the analysis shows that about 6 million people would not respond to the census if that question is on there. I think statistically, numerically, that's close to about the size of the state of Missouri, something like that.
Yeah.
So you get into a situation where if this is on there, there's going to be real problems. I'm not quite sure if it makes it on, but this is going to be another test, and everything looks like it's heading to the Supreme Court these days.
Yeah, that's right. They're really going to be the final arbiter. And we'll talk about the emergency. We'll talk more about this, too. But in Texas in particular, Latinos population is going to be estimated to be over 11 million by 2022. And what the Census Bureau also found was that about 1.5% of Hispanics were not able to be located for the census. So you're talking here potentially about Texas giving away about $40 to $50 billion in all kinds of things like SNAP money, highway money, construction. It's funny because the state in the past, and Texas has done everything they could to try to make sure everybody got counted, right? Both Governor Clements and Governor Bush issued executive orders to make sure that they got all of the people in Texas counted because it translates to real dollars. So this is going to be something which has a tremendous impact on Texas, but also on the nation.
Brandy, you know what the most insecure job in the world is? Working
that?
For the Trump administration.
Right.
Because
don't even update your resume.
Don't update it. Yes. Yeah. In fact, you might not even want to add it on there because it's like a revolving door.
Right.
Well, the president has lost another potential replacement to an already leaving cabinet appointee in Nikki Haley, who was the UN ambassador. She stepped down, and he had talked about Heather Nauert, who was a State Department spokesperson, as her replacement. She's now withdrawn her name. So we've got a bunch of interims, yeah. And in some cases, we don't even have nominees.
And why she withdrew was interesting, right? It's because there was, in her past, somebody she had hired to be a nanny who didn't have proper paperwork to work in the U.S. So, again, this is another kind of 90s-type scandal, right, which befell Bill Clinton by so much. But this is a problem for the White House because of the people that he's choosing. But it's also a staffing problem, right? I mean, this is an issue where we've talked about many times, right? The amount of turnover is upwards of 80% in these top jobs. And this is a position that the U.S. desperately needs if they're going to kind of use this as an anchor for their ability to connect to the rest of the world. So I think this is a tremendous problem. And they're going to find somebody. But like you say, the turnover is such that I'm not sure there are a lot of people out there who are just willing to work for the White House anymore.
And she herself was, I think, roundly criticized as a potential pick because she lacked, I think, substantive sort of foreign policy experience. And we're seeing that as a whole in the foreign policy apparatus in the White House. Speaking of foreign policy, the president has ventured into that. He's primarily been sort of domestically oriented, but now he is sort of turned his attention to an increasingly difficult situation in Venezuela. Went down to Miami, gave a rabble-rousing speech, almost threatening kind of invasion. And if you know anything about the history of the U.S. in South America and in Latin America, kind of the exact opposite of what you need to do if you're trying to get people, who's essentially telling the Venezuelan military that they better sort of kind of stage a coup on Nicolas Maduro or else.
This is risky, Jay. I mean, don't you think that given the history, like you say, and given, frankly, where the president is in terms of a foreign policy ambiguity is like a serious problem. To me, it says the Trump White House wants to pivot to foreign policy issues. I mean, domestic policy-wise, they're probably like just barely afloat, right? I mean, the economy is probably right on the brink of a potential problem. The tax cut legislation is not helping much as much as they thought it would. So domestically, things haven't moved as quickly as he wanted. But the foreign policy side of things, presidents can always pivot to. So Venezuela is a good example of that. And North Korea, too, right? There's a summit coming up, which we'll talk about in the next couple of weeks in Vietnam. So the president, I think, politically is trying to use this as leverage, but I'm not sure it's the best way to do it. What do you think about the risk involved?
Yeah, look, I think that the president it made a huge blunder in being so vociferous in talking about sort of overthrowing the government. It has almost the opposite effect. The role for the U.S., particularly in some of the Latin American countries, has historically been as kind of this almost imposed power. And so the problem and the challenge you have is how do you influence the outcome without looking overbearing? And the president really does only knows one speed, and that's overbearing. And so that's why it was probably a mistake to do this. Look, I think this was about the optics of going down to a place like Florida, with the largest sort of expat Venezuelan population in the country, trying to influence a little bit of the politics there.
Really? Politics involved in foreign policy? I thought it was
shocking,
supposed to stop at the water's
edge. Shocking. So I'm not sure how productive it was.
Hey, you know what would help, though, the president, I think, in that? This would be a Nobel Peace Prize, right, for just generally being solid on foreign policy. And if he had a good enough friend, maybe he could ask that friend to nominate him for one. Jay, what do you think about that idea?
That's right. Well, the president of the United States, who is, you know, who's oftentimes criticized other people for being sort of, you know, wanting participation trophies and accusing people of being a snowflake, I guess, is the term that he likes to use. But apparently asked the Japanese prime minister to nominate him for a Nobel Peace Prize, I suspect because he thinks he's contributed so much in the last couple of years. The Japanese prime minister has sort of walked that back dramatically, saying he certainly didn't want to do it. He was asked to do it. Kind of a not exactly the finest moment for the president.
Yeah, not an auspicious start to the, your Nobel Peace Prize presentation, right? But what I'm hoping is that maybe you'll nominate me for one. I don't know. I'll just throw it out there in case, you know, you're...
I'm going to take cue from the Japanese prime minister and just make no comment.
No comment. Well, let's shift to Texas and talk a little bit about the Senate race coming up, Jay. There's a new poll out from the left-leaning public policy polling company that suggests that John Cornyn and Beto O'Rourke, should they match up, are very close within about 2 percentage points. What do you think about that?
Yeah, margin of error. Look, I don't think Beto's going to run for Senate because I think he's going to run for president of the United States because otherwise, why do you go to spend time at the University of Wisconsin?
It's cold there.
Yeah. in the middle of winter, certainly not because you're running talking about John Cornyn. I think the poll certainly shows that the state is more competitive. And I think John Cornyn is vulnerable in large parts because of the sort of structural changes we've seen in Texas. And Cornyn himself, I think, may or may not end up being ultimately the nominee. I don't believe for a second that the lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick, is really going to give him a pass. But we'll see. You never know. But I do think it's a positive sign for Democrats as a whole. I just don't think Beto O'Rourke's going to be the nominee for the Democrats for U.S. Senate.
Yeah. I mean, compared to the numbers that O'Rourke had versus Cruz, say, at this point in the race, you know, for 18, and they were nowhere near as close. So if it's the case that O'Rourke wants to run, you know, the framework is there. So if the question was whether or not people were still going to back him, I think the answer here is probably. Another thing I think this highlights is the fact that a lot of Democrats in Texas want him to stay in Texas and run. This shows that that would be successful for them, right? It also shows, I think, you as you noted, like the structural disadvantage that Republicans are going to have in 2020. And that is because, in part, this poll also shows that Trump's job performance basically is flat even, right? 48 approve, 47 disapprove. So he is vulnerable, which makes Cornyn vulnerable. And I think that's probably going to make this a pretty competitive race.
Brandon, we just had Valentine's Day, and I don't know what your wife Tracy got you or... But I bet it wasn't some special legislation to kind of clean up your record.
Yeah, it would have been great, right? No, sadly, it was, you know, not anywhere near the legislative realm. But, you know, it was tasty, at least. So, yeah, you've got Angela Paxton, right? Which, if people haven't been paying attention, this is filed legislation, which would effectively give her husband more regulatory power, including the ability to issue exemptions from securities regulations. But there's a catch, Jay, right? The catch is that Ken Paxton, the attorney general, is currently under indictment for violating such a law from 2015. So what's your take on kind of where this strikes in the ethical balance of legislative and political affairs?
Yeah, I think the idea of ethics in Ken Paxton has been diverging for a long time. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about someone who's been attorney general for now five and a half years, through that entire period has been under an ethical cloud as a result of this. Senator Angela Paxton from the Dallas area filing this legislation to essentially help her husband. It's just a bad look. There's no scenario where it makes any sense. At least go through the fiction of having somebody else do it for you.
Right.
For her to have done this, I think is just completely silly. This probably would not even been a major story if you had had a colleague do this. The fact that Angela Paxton is doing this to essentially help Ken Paxton is probably bad form. Well, it's not probably. It is bad form.
Bad form. When she announced she was running, the first thing I thought was that, okay, if she wins, there is no negative mark on the Paxton brand. And I think the fact that this is still happening with all of the clear ethical implications shows that there's no real mark on the Paxton brand, at least in terms of her constituency. Maybe statewide, we saw his challenger get close to him. I think that the marriage, no pun intended, of the politics and policy here are uncomfortably close and need to be very carefully vetted. But there's also separation of power issues, right? Here you're talking about the legislative branch essentially giving more power to the attorney general. That's something which does happen, and we've seen other states make that move. But the attorney general in Texas has a very limited role. And we talked about a couple weeks ago how the AG has been asking for more money for more different types of prosecutions of types of cases that are politically very hot, like abortion and issues involving human trafficking. So this is something where I think the separation of powers is really kind of drawn into question. I don't think legislation is going to go anywhere, but the kind of regulatory questions here with respect to what the AG is going to be able to do, I think are still on the table.
Brandon, let's take a quick look at what's going on in Houston and Harris County and the surrounding Gulf Coast area. A couple big things popped up. The district attorney, Kim Ogg, who's sort of been nationally hailed as a criminal justice reformer, got her hand pretty severely slapped by Harris County Commissioner's Court. She asked for, I want to say, 100 new prosecutors. Mm-hmm. She's claiming that was to try to get back caseloads, backlogs that she had. They said, no way, you don't want more prosecutors. More prosecutors means more convictions. We're trying to clear up the jail system. This is the exact kind of reform we don't. It was a heated discussion, but the big issue to me on this was sort of part of a national issue about what does criminal justice reform mean? Ogg was kind of that first wave of reform DAs. Now they're looking for even further reform, and you've got progressive interest groups kind of pushing back against her. This is going to be an ongoing discussion. I would say Kim Ogg's probably, I think, I would side with her on this from a purely policy perspective. But this is something to look at because it's happening here in Houston. I think it's going to happen nationally as well.
Yeah, I'm not surprised it happened. I'm surprised how fast it happened, right? And now she has a challenger. That is, Ogg has a challenger. Audia Jones, the former assistant district attorney, is running to outflank Ogg on the left. And she's suggested that basically this is part of the reason why, right? All these progressives are moving in this direction to, you know, bail reform, to have bail reform, which they say Ogg hasn't done enough of, or there are too many marijuana arrests, right, which Lita Hidalgo suggested a couple of weeks ago. The Texas Organizing Project, which backed Ogg in 16, is opposing this. So the energy of the Democratic Party is moving very fast to the left, and that it's outflanked her in a very quick way.
Yeah, so I think what we're seeing here in Houston is just a microcosm of what's happening nationally. Speaking of which, we're also seeing the mayor of Houston and the Houston firefighters are in this kind of epic throwdown battle here for supremacy. The mayor is pushing back hard, will not stop. There was a voter-approved proposition to create pay parity. The firefighters believe they are owed quite a bit of money. The mayor keeps fighting it in court. Kind of the first time that a voter-approved referendum is being challenged by the sitting mayor. You've also got an election around the corner. In November of 2019, the mayor's in an election year. He's talking layoffs. He can't get the budget. He's got council members mad at him. And one of the most popular, if not the most popular, labor union in the area is in open warfare against him.
Yeah, the last 6 months have been a real struggle for the mayor. And if this isn't solved in, or at least addressed in some significant way, it could bleed into the election. It's clearly going to be part of what, like, Bill King, who's running, and Tony Busby, who's also running, are going to talk about. So it'd be nice to have some resolution on this, but I think you're definitely going to see this as a big part of what's going to happen and talked about in 2019.
Brandon, before we start talking about the wall and getting into the details of whether it's going to get built or not get built, we have to take a moment and thank the members of Congress because they are saving the butterflies.
Right. The butterflies are protected, Jay, right? So there was a lot of debate about where the wall would be. Part of the problem was that it was apparently going to be right through the National Butterfly Center, which is a really interesting place to visit if you've never been. Bipartisan agreement in the budget deal basically includes protections for this refugee area for butterflies, not for people. That's a different problem. So butterflies in some ways have, I guess, come out of this ahead, right? Politically, they're doing well. I wonder who their lobbyist is, right?
Well, at least for now, because we don't know. But let's talk wall, Brandon. We know that the president announced that there was a national emergency. To use his phrase, he could build it. He's got enough. It's just going to take him longer. So he's decided to call a national emergency. This, of course, has been met with what we might expect. 19 attorney generals from across the country have filed a lawsuit, essentially saying that the president is not adequately using the designation for national emergencies mm-hmm. appropriately. It's going to be going up to the court system and likely end up in the Supreme Court. There's a lot to unpack here. Let's talk about it. First off, is it a national emergency, Brandon?
I mean, it doesn't look like it is. I mean, part of the problem is the way the statute's defined. You have to include the military as part of it, and in peacetime and along a border with a country that we're at peace with and are friends, doesn't seem to meet that qualification, right? Now, the Constitution gives the president expanded powers in times of war, but it's not clear this is a time of war, right? Even if there is some kind of a crisis, which I'm not sure there is, and there's been a lot of debate about whether the crossings constitute any kind of conflict, but it seems like, although the statute is written very broadly and Congress has interpreted it fairly broadly, that this is not a true emergency. Jay, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the problem for the president, leaving aside his commentary, is that the data doesn't support it. So the president is essentially trying to make the argument that illegal border crossings and drugs coming flowing into the country is what constitutes a national emergency. The problem is the data from Homeland Security says that border crossings are dramatically down. Illegal crossings are dramatically down. In fact, we've had a decline in net illegal immigration to the United States, at least according to the data that they collect. The bigger problem I think he has is, because to use the wartime argument, was whether or not that he could use sort of the quote-unquote war on drugs with international terrorists and narco-terrorists as a means to kind of justify building the wall. The problem is the DEA's own data says about 85% of all drugs flowing to the country come in through legal ports of entry. And they have actually made the argument that what we need is a lot more technology and a lot more manpower at legal ports of entry to interdict for drugs. So that's where I think he's going to have a real, real problem justifying this. His commentary doesn't help his case, but I think the facts themselves, the data itself, doesn't support it. And we haven't even gotten to the point that most of the land along the border, particularly here in Texas, is in private hands. It is going to be a litigation nightmare to try to go in and use eminent domain to essentially build these things. I will say this now. There is no way they're going to build the wall the way they want to build the wall. This is entirely a political process.
Well, and the question here gets obviously adjudicated by the courts, right? And they're going to have to apply these arguments that have been used to limit presidential power in the past to this case. Traditionally, it's been the case that if Congress has objected to the use of a particular power from the president, then the president's power are what we call at the lowest ebb. And this comes out of the 1950s and some of Truman's steel seizure cases that limited him in the ability to be able to basically collect capital and the means of production. So I think that's a real problem. But if we are counting on the courts to stop him, that's a risky gambit because the courts have been very lenient when it comes to presidential power. I think this will be a kind of a test of how weak presidential executive responsibility is viewed by the court. So if it's the case that they think that this is something which is logical, right, and they don't look at all the other issues, then it could be that this Supreme Court in particular, two of whom he's appointed, right, says that this counts as something that the president can do, then we will know the degree to which they're comfortable with that executive power.
Yeah, the courts have given great deference to the executive when it comes to their ability, especially on national security matters. I think the challenge of this cycle is going to be whether or not the president can justify any use of that power. Because as you said, Congress has explicitly decided not to fund them. And in doing so, for the president to do it, I think it is going to create that constitutional crisis that we talk about. My sense is, just based on the nine members of the court, that you have at least five members. Three or four, I think, from a policy perspective, they think it's wrong. But John Roberts, the Chief Justice, is an institutionalist for the court and has long argued about equal separation and separation of powers, and I think would certainly be inclined to side with the other four. I think the two recent appointees have been the most lenient when it comes to executive authority. Brett Kavanaugh in particular has written on this subject. So to me, I think a 5-4 decision at the minimum is what we're looking at against the president. You may get a unanimous decision against the president on this because I do think the law is very much against the president. And I think they know that.
I think you're right. I mean, it's odd that Scalia's gone because he had written very critically of President Obama on the EPA greenhouse regulations, right? Striking that down, saying that this was something that Congress expressly rejected, right? They did not authorize. So the president has no power to do it. If Gorsuch and Kavanaugh are in that same mindset of Scalia, I think we're going to see that 9-0 decision, as you said. But to me, the bigger problem here is Congress. They've delegated so much power to the presidency in the past century that this is a problem of their own making. So they can undo it. Will they undo it, Jay? What's your sense? Are they going to step in the middle of this, or are they going to let the court handle it?
I think they're going to let the court handle it because I don't know that there's 60 votes in the Senate to override that veto. Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our coordinating producer, who's always watching for emergencies, Ernie Manous. Special kudos to our web and graphics team at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, Big Audio Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.